Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula. Bill Russell and I are talking with Dr. John McGuire. I keep having this image of a 19-year-old boy who comes out of Alabama and has this chance encounter with greatness, who, in the form of Dr. He wasn't then doctor, but Martin Luther King Jr. And I keep everything you say, I can sort of see bridges from that early experience. And I have this sense of, well, maybe you would have done these things even if you hadn't been at this moment as the world is having the great citizens' revolution of the 20th century, that you probably would have done just fine had you not met Martin Luther King Jr., and you did. And it takes you all of these places, scholarship, community organizing, politics, and it takes you perhaps improbably into the arts. Where's the connection there?
I am living proof that higher education can make a difference in an individual's life. Coming from Alabama and Florida, the two states in which I lived as a boy, anything having to do with the arts was for sissies. Real men never knew poetry, never read any poetry. Certainly, we had in Floral, Alabama, no art gallery, certainly anything that I recall.
Not everybody knows where that is.
Floral, Alabama derives its name from being on the Florida-Alabama state line near Mobile. At any rate, the enormous liberation for me came in college at Washington and Lee to come under the spell of a poet, to become the friend of a painter, a great Southern painter, Marion Junkin, whose son I got to tutor in math, and who, as a reward, since he didn't have much money, allowed my soon-to-be wife, whose anniversary I celebrate with 50 years this in a matter of weeks, to go into his studio and pick two paintings as payment for having gotten young Toby through high school math. And that started our art collecting. And we suddenly realized our first married year was in Europe. We went straight from our marriage in North Carolina, her home, to Edinburgh, to Scotland. And then the traveling for 4.5 months throughout Europe. I think we went to every gallery, every cathedral. We were absolutely the dewy-eyed, innocent tourists abroad, but came home with a profound love for, and when people say they're moved by works of art, I experienced that in a heavy way at the age of 21, 22, but the great thing had been prepared to appreciate it by those college years and knew it was all right for a man to own those powerful emotions. Then I got interested in the question of how emotions are shaped, not, as the poet said, undisciplined squads of emotion, but how do you give form to feeling? That is easily transferable in a life to how do you give form to conviction? How do you give form to values? How do you give form to your vision? I began the pursuit of a passion for the arts, which has culminated in a reasonably fair collection of painting and sculpture. I have a daughter who's a professional dancer, modern dancer, so I certainly have an equity position in her dance company. So all the lively arts, a respect for fascination with architecture. You can't live in a town with Frank Gehry and not be interested in what's happening, or Richard Meyer in architecture here and there. But of all the forms, the one that has engaged me most in the recent years, there was a period where I was a theater buff. Billy and I just were
Billy wild. Is your wife.
That's right, about theater. We drive into Los Angeles less than we used to do to go to theater, but the form that has emerged as the preeminent passion is poetry. And again, through happenstance, I had a chance by an incredible invitation of a woman who shortly after she approached me died and left $2 million to the university on the condition that there be established in her late husband's name what has emerged as the largest single prize for poetry in the United States, the Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award. And in fact, a distinguished Atlanta-based poet, Thomas Lux at Georgia Tech, was the second winner in a series that's now 11 years old. So the Kingsley Tufts are very, very important. And that brought me into touch because she was very clear about the national panel. She also had a little activist streak, Kate Tufts, and wanted not the poets all to be academically based, but Anne Quinn from the New Yorker magazine, she wanted people who saw that poetry found its way into popular print as well as arcane verse. At any rate, I'm convinced that that was the reason why on my retirement I was invited to become a kind of poetry impresario, that is to say, to run every summer along with a poet who at the time was not connected to the Atlanta-based Thomas Lux at all, but now is married to him, the great California poet, then Cecilia Wallach, to put together a week-long summer poetry festival in the mountains at Idlewild near Palm Springs. And so one of the very important, there are probably four or five of these throughout the United States, but certainly one of the very important ones is the Idlewild Summer Poetry Festival, which brings two towering poets in residence each summer to join a teaching faculty that keeps returning each year of great poets. And incidentally, we always have spot for one visitor in the teaching corps, and it will be in Atlanta. Natasha Trethewey of Emory University will be the visiting teaching poet in the faculty this summer. And then on a daily basis, Southern California is so rich in poets, come up to camp every evening a poet or two. And so in the evening, we kind of have a poetic hootenanny and have a poetry read every night for featuring about 15 minutes each from the two great poets. Last summer, it was Galway Connell and Sharon Olds, and the summer before that, Billy Collins and Lucille Clifton. And so as a pair, this year it'll be Carolyn Kaiser and Jerry Stern. Next summer, Youssef Kumanyaka and Ellen Voigt. So they read, and then they're joined by often equally well-known poets who just happen to live nearby and will come up for a night. And then twice in the week, this teaching faculty, since they themselves are distinguished poets, read. So it's an absolute morning, noon to night immersion in poetry. And it's exhilarating for me. And we look forward to every week, the July week every summer, and doing that at the Idlewild Poetry Festival.
I have the sense that there's an alternate universe out there that I have been missing, and I won't find it in the media. Thomas Lux and it really introduces us to it here in Atlanta. There are a lot of people doing poetry. There are Absolutely. A lot of people, you know, turning out thousands of people for a poetry reading is, to me, a remarkable condition. And I don't know if this alternate universe has been there all along or if this is something new.
I get clammy at the too easy use of the term spirituality. Nevertheless, if it's used in the tough sense that real spirituality ought to be called that, this has to do with the phenomenon of growth in fascination with, engagement with spirituality. Because I think poetry represents an alternative discourse, and it's a different way of giving voice to those same deep feelings and convictions that are also deeply there in spirituality. I know they're first cousins, and in some ways, for many poets, take Mary Oliver as a classic example, who with no orthodoxy, nevertheless, is clearly giving rise, well, the way Yeats did, giving rise to religious vision in a secular language, suffused with the power of emotion, and turning out gorgeous, gorgeous poetry. So it's not all just whimsical or difficult or arcane. I think people are drawn to it. And one of the things I happen to believe that of all the art forms, it's the one even adults are most willing to tackle for the first time because they're drawn to it. If you said, I want you to paint me a painting, oh, I can't. I have no gift in that. Not that all the products of the people who try poetry are memorable, sometimes for their awfulness. But at any rate, there's some connection there that people believe, I have those feelings, and I can form them and give them expression in a poem. It is, though, you're right, sociologically, the people that study the sociology of the arts declare it, the run of all the art forms, it's the runaway form. Just poetry slams bring out 2,000 people in clubs in the overspill courtyards in California. It's a big, big phenomenon.
We have a friend who's a philosopher who started his career in theology. His name is Frederick Furay, and his core description of what humans do or are is a word, he's a coined word called calogenesis. It is the creation and the discovery of beauty. And I think that as I understand what you're saying and describing, I think that's broad and disciplined search for spirituality, but it also includes this aesthetic component that seems to be absolutely central.
No, it does. I not quibble. The only thing I think that often they don't have people who are fledgling poets or even practiced poets necessarily have beauty as a goal or an end toward which they're aspiring. I think they're more possessed of the feeling of necessity to say something. We're back where we started, the dilemma of saying and doing. I was reminded of a wonderful story the other night. It is said that in April of a year, John Foster Dulles came into Eisenhower. Eisenhower's Secretary of State, and proudly said, "Mr. President, it's only April, and I've already traveled 400,000 miles." And he says, "Don't do something, Foster. Stand there." So poetry represents the other side. It's standing there.
Here I stand.
John McGuire is our guest. He will continue to be our guest when we return in just a moment.